We're going to get started. It's about 7 o'clock. Thank you all for coming. I'm Smiles Lewis. I'm the founder and president of the Anomaly Archives, which is the lending library of the nonprofit 501c3 Scientific Anomaly Institute. We're over 10 years old. We started in the early 2000s, 2003. And our mission is the preservation of UFO and anomalous science-related materials. We have a collection of over 3,000 books and hundreds, if not thousands, of magazines, periodicals, and we're growing daily. We've got a large number of paper files, news clippings that have been accumulated from various researchers, and I'm excited to announce that we have several new collections that are going to be donated soon that I can't really say much about yet, but we're just excited to know that there are researchers who are interested in preserving their research materials in an organization such as ours. We're thankfully located up in Northwest Austin in the offices of the INAX organization known as the Institute for Neuroscience and Consciousness Studies. Thankfully, they let us have our materials housed there. So the subject of Bigfoot and cryptozoology in general is one of those subjects that has always intrigued me. It, in some ways, was that gateway drug for my interest in all kinds of anomalous phenomena. I think that's really probably true of a lot of researchers. I've certainly heard a number of personal accounts where people, whether they be parapsychologists or ufologists or whatever particular brand of the paranormal that they like, they almost always can relate to, you know, picking up that book on the Loch Ness Monster or Bigfoot in their elementary school library, and I'm no different in that regards. But most people still have this image of Bigfoot as being something that's exclusively part of the Pacific Northwest, when in fact it appears that there are at least sightings reports that are in almost every state in North America. But even then, people still don't really tend to think of the southern Bigfoot. They again think of, you know, the cooler climates of the Pacific Northwest, but in fact a number of the southern Bigfoot researchers swear that every southern state has had sightings of these strange, mysterious alleged creatures. And interestingly, I just as I think in the past, where UFOs were an incredibly popular topic and there were UFO sky-watching groups all around the country, I think we've seen a shift towards a popularity of Bigfoot and cryptozoology that is part of a new cultural movement, perhaps. It largely, I think, promulgated by the money-mongering producers of reality TV shows. Reality TV shows.
One of them would talk to me.
But there's been a number of interesting areas of growth in the study of Bigfoot. I've often said that I think that some of the most significant discoveries may in fact come not from the Pacific Northwest, but right from here in Texas. For a time in the early 2000s, there were at least two different Bigfoot conferences here in Texas. Now there's just one, but it's been going on every year now. Since early 2001, and there are several that are still going on around the country. Just recently, there was one that was planned for Arkansas, but unfortunately was postponed due to the terrible tornadoes that they experienced. But Oklahoma has also a rich cryptozoological history, but we've recently seen movies like The Wild Man of the Navidad, a 2008 retro-styled horror movie set in the region northwest of Victoria, Texas, which is a retelling of some of the more classic Wild Man stories that seem to go in one direction of one aspect of these claims of encounters with hairy, crazy, wild men in the woods. And a year earlier, there was a really interesting documentary called Southern Fried Bigfoot that I would recommend folks look into. And I myself have talked to people who've claimed to have had sightings in places as close by as Driftwood, Texas, down in Manchac, Texas. And as well as there's, you may or may not know about the Hairy Man Road legends up in Round Rock. They actually have now a family-friendly festival every year. I think their big claim is to have a beard growing contest or something. That's a different kind of interpretation of Hairy Man. And in fact, that Hairy Man Road legend is almost more of a ghost type of story, but it has elements of the wild man running through the narratives. But I think this is a subject that appeals to a lot of different people, not just children. I am happy to see that so many researchers I know are doing public outreach in the form of going to elementary schools and lecturing to the students about the subject of Bigfoot and using that as entree to the realm of science and rational investigation, which I know a lot of people, when they think Bigfoot, they don't think rational science or physical evidence, but that is, of course, the holy grail that people have been looking for, but it really all comes down to the stories. And without making an appeal to authority, I would say that, if you doubt the existence of Bigfoot, it may surprise you to learn that primatologist Jane Goodall has on no less than two occasions over the course of 10 years claimed that she believes in the existence of a North American primate, an undiscovered North American hominid. She made this the first time I became aware of this is in her 2002 appearance on NPR, where she said, "I've talked to so many Native Americans who all describe the same sounds, too, who have seen them. I've probably got about 30 books that have come from different parts of the world." And she, as recently as 2012, was quoted in the Huffington Post as still holding that belief. Now, belief isn't necessarily about science or rationality. But again, this is somebody who's made her life's work the investigation of primates. And so I do take her word with at least a significantly larger chunk of salt than some other people who claim to believe in these subjects. Now, one of the things I like about Rob, we've known each other for about, well, over 10 years now. And I've had the pleasure of going on at least one overnight expedition into the thicket with Rob and some other fellow Texas Bigfoot researchers. And he's one of those people that I like because he is not afraid to look in directions that most blood and guts type Bigfoot researchers are afraid to even touch. And that's the idea that there's something more to these creatures than perhaps is understandable in terms of normal critters that one might encounter in the woods. And this tend to revolve around the issues of why are they so elusive? Why don't we have some sort of physical evidence? And while there might be something, some simple explanation as simple as, well, if they are more hominids, there may have a culture and they may have a means and a reason for staying away from humans and keeping their existence a secret. But there may be something else there that goes into the realm of the paranormal and the psychic. But again, this is an area that in Rob's investigations, I think he's very well read and has done a good job of trying to synthesize the various paranormal and parapsychological data that could be used to bolster some of the more speculative and wilder ideas about the nature of this elusivity. But he's also, occasionally touched on the subject of the connection between UFOs and Bigfoot. And that's an area that most Bigfoot researchers, they don't want to go anywhere near that. And same with UFO researchers. They don't want to go anywhere near the subject of of Bigfoot. But think on this. Such staunchly skeptical UFO researchers as Canada's Chris Rutkowski has contributed just recently to a book called In the Woods, a collection of fiction, poetry, sighting reports, and photos. Also, Professor Michael Swords, who is one of the higher-ups in the Center for UFO Studies that was founded by J. Allen Hynek, he is the main holder of the Situ Archives. The Situ Archives were the organization founded by Ivan Sanderson, who was a biologist and zoologist who coined the phrase cryptozoology back in the 1940s. And so here is just a couple of UFO researchers who have actually, they may not necessarily espouse claims of the connection between these phenomena, but they're at least expressing a regular interest in this. I just learned yesterday from a February 2014 interview with my favorite UFO researcher, Jacques Vallée, that back in 2012 and 2013, he began investigating cryptozoological sightings in the Utah region with scientist Frank Salisbury. And researchers such as Jerome Clark and Lauren Coleman, who's considered to be the world's foremost cryptozoologist, in their 1975 book called The Unidentified, which Jerome Clark and to some degree Lauren have both disavowed, they put forth the theories that have come to be called para-ufology, and which encompass this kind of synthesis of paranormal, parapsychological information and its possible relevance to the study of Bigfoot and other cryptids. And just this weekend, up in Pennsylvania, another bastion of Bigfoot research, the 9th annual Kecksburg UFO Fest is going on, and their theme is UFOs and Bigfoot. So, while I don't think Rob's necessarily going to go talking too much in that direction, I just thought it worthy to mention that. Finally, I would just like to quote a researcher, and she's from the English department at the University of Houston, and Lauren Coleman brought me to her attention. There was a conference up in his neck of the woods, Portland, Maine, back in November of 2007 called CODE, the 21st Annual Conference of the Society for Literature, Science, and the Arts. And the theme was CODE, but it was actually about cryptids, this idea of the cryptozoological and its relevance to a wide swath of inquiry. And there's a lot of quotes from her I'd like to read, but I'll just end with this one. She cited folklorist Peter Dendel, who has written that cryptozoology is, quote, more important now than ever because of a felt need to, quote, repopulate liminal space with potentially undiscovered creatures that have resisted human devastation. She also said, it is time then for the term cryptid to take on a broader meaning, referencing as it does the uncanniness of human-animal encounters, that familiar otherness about non-human species that so unnerves yet intrigues us. The term serves as a useful conceptualization in cultural studies of species, which is, finally, the ultimate work of natural science, cryptozoology, anthropology, and any creative representation of non-human others. So without further ado, please welcome our guest, Rob Riggs.
Well, before I get started, I want to donate a copy of each of my books to the Anomaly Archives. I have appreciation for what y'all are doing and out of my long friendship and support from Smiles.
Richard Reeves.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, and we have a sign-up sheet that we're going to be passing around, as well as a donation ban. This is a free event, but we are a nonprofit struggling, as so many are. So if you have anything that you can give, we would greatly appreciate it. And thank you again for coming.
And I will have copies of my book for sale if anybody's interested after this. After this, you may not be.
Your book, and it's really neat.
Thank you. Which one?
The one about Big Thicket.
Okay.
Is that your first or second?
That's my first one. I wanted to show y'all, this is the official National Park Service map of the Big Thicket National Preserve. Now, this is so far east in Texas that the furthest east city that you see there is Liberty. This is way east of Houston. And the major city in this region is Beaumont, right here to the right. And I'm fond of calling Beaumont the largest city in Texas east of Houston. And there's not much between Houston and New Orleans, but Beaumont and a couple of Cajun towns. So this is a preserve. This totals a little over 100,000 acres of the original Big Thicket ecosystem, which technically the Big Thicket is the southern and the southwestern terminus of the Piney Woods ecosystem. Now, the Piney Woods ecosystem and encompasses most of East Texas, and then western and northern Louisiana, primarily west of the Chaffalaya Basin, and then southern Arkansas and southeastern Oklahoma. And all of those regions have a high incidence of Bigfoot sightings and have had for years. In fact, after the Pacific Northwest and maybe the Ohio River system, the Piney Woods region has the highest number of Bigfoot sightings in the country. And Texas alone, and it depends on what poll you look at, but Texas frequently ranks in the top 10 of the UFO sightings. And it's not just because we're a big state. It's mainly because of the Piney Woods. Now, I am a native of this little town right here. Is that showing up?
Yeah.
Okay. At Syro Lake, Texas, population 1,680. And when I graduated from high school, the population was 1,602 or something like that. So it hasn't changed much, and it's one of the least affected areas in the country by what I call the modern urban American culture, because it's such an isolated place. And you have the old traditional Southern culture there. But this region here, green area here is called the Lance Rozier Unit of the Big Thicket National Preserve. The all these different areas up here are they're called units. One time, of course, this was all the Big Thicket, and what they've done, and this is one of the most important conservation efforts in Texas history, in my opinion, is that they managed to save over 100,000 acres of it. And that took many, many years of conservation work and really proactive. But this is called the Lance Rozier Unit. And this is what the old timers used to call the Bear Thicket, because it had a very, very high population of Louisiana black bears. They have almost been hunted to extinction. We've had a few bears that have wandered back in, but that's what it was famous for. So you can get an idea of the layout. Now, it's interesting, but Miles was talking about people being interested in this stuff. I read a statistic recently that about 85% of Texans live in urban and suburban environments. And most people rarely get out into any wild places like in the Big Thicket. And I've talked to people like reporters from Houston and stuff that came out and interviewed me. And I said, well, you know where Sour Lake is? No. I said, well, you know where Beaumont is? Well, they kind of knew where Beaumont was. But most people just whiz through on I-10 if they're going to New Orleans. And very few people that don't live in that region ever go there. So don't have a lot of high awareness of what it's like. So let me show you this slide. This will give you some idea. Smile said, you got a PowerPoint presentation, don't you? I said, I will by the time I get there. So I had to go out and buy the PowerPoint and learn how to use it in a hurry. So these are kind of rudimentary slides, but it'll give you the idea. This will give you an idea of what the Lance Rozier Unit vegetation is like. It's hardwood, palmetto bottoms. This particular region of the Big Thicket is classified by botanists as the only jungle in the United States. Yeah. Now, who would have thought that the only jungle in the United States was in Texas, right? So this is typical of that. Now, you can imagine, you can walk just within the preserve. You can walk around 60 miles of this stuff, solid, all the way to the Neches River from up by Saratoga.
Is Tyler in this area?
No, sir. Tyler is way up north, 200 miles north. This is extreme southeastern Texas. So you get the idea of the location. The geology is that it's basically, this part of Texas is actually considered part of the Mississippi Delta. If you go from just west of Galveston Bay, just east of Galveston Bay, it's marshes all the way from there to Mississippi. And so it's actually part of that same delta system. That's why the water is muddy in the Gulf on the upper coast. So that gives you an idea what it looks like. This part, it's interesting, but the big thicket, especially this region, was one of the last parts of Texas that was settled by white people. And I should say that it was by any kind of people, because traditionally the Indians of the region wouldn't live in this part of the big thicket, because they said that they believed it was haunted by evil spirits. And there's no record of any of the coastal Indians, the Caraquas or the Uthacupans or the Caddos from further north. They didn't build any villages in this region. And some said that the only time they would come in would be for hunting parties. This was the original artwork for the cover of my second book that I co-authored with Tom Burnett. And we had to change it because I told the artist that the nose and the ears were too human looking, and that they needed to be a little more ape looking. But I wanted to show y'all because I really liked see how he blended in the lights and the fog and everything. So anyhow, I thought he did a great job on it. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a zoologist or biochemist or anything of the type. And I don't have a formula or any hard data that I can give you that, in my mind, would prove the existence of these creatures. And furthermore...
Say that again, what you just said?
Yeah, I said I'm not a scientist. I don't have any data that I can present to you that I say is evidence or proof of the existence of these creatures. What I am is a journalist and a reporter. And what my books are based on are over about 40 years of interviewing people, of people who had encounters, sightings, many of them that were traumatic to them, of a range of different phenomena. And we'll talk about how I think that fits together, but including Bigfoot. And Miles is talking about how people normally associate Pacific Northwest with Bigfoot. And I always say that my co-author and I, we don't even claim that what we're studying is the same animal. It could be an entirely different hominid or entirely different primate. And as I like to say this, especially when we're on the West Coast, our station is that I'm sure that the Bigfoot in the Pacific Northwest are much smarter and much more educated and politically correct, and that the Southern Bigfoot are no doubt more redneck. So, the first I became aware of a Bigfoot type creature in the Big Thicket was in 1952. I was 7 years old at the time. And there were rumors circulating around the county that people were seeing what they called a hairy wild man in different parts of the woods. And the stories were serious enough that the local county newspaper, the Coontz News, began investigating it. And they found out that the sheriff's department had actually gone out and investigated a couple of incidences, and that they found large barefoot tracks. And people described it in various ways, but basically, it looked like a naked, hairy man. And speculation was that it was some kind of escaped convict or mental patient from Rusk that had somehow evolved the survival skills to survive in the woods. My grandfather, who took an interest in the stories, didn't believe that, because he thought that there's nobody that could survive naked in the big thicket, and that it almost had to be some kind of unknown animal. I took the story seriously when I was a little kid, but as I got older, I just assumed that there was nothing to it. Now, keep in mind, this was in 1952. This was 6 years before the word Bigfoot was ever made up in California. And I'm fond of quoting that statistic, because some people say, "Oh, the Southern Bigfoot, they're just trying to get in on the Bigfoot craze." No, these sightings go back to before Bigfoot. After I grew up, and you're talking about the waves. That actually was a wave, a localized wave of interest in Hairy Apes. The sightings tend to come and go. There seems to be times when they're more abundant, and then there are times when they're not as many. But after I ended up graduating from high school and I came to school here at UT, and of course got a good liberal education, I had pretty much forgotten about the wild man stories, or just assumed that it was folklore, or people just, you know, mistaken identity. But as fate would have it, I ended up getting into journalism with my worthless English degree from the University of Texas. I managed to get a job working for the very newspaper that I read about wild men when I was a kid in my home area. And after I'd been there a while, I started writing a column. And for curiosity, I wondered whether anybody had still, if there were still any wild man sightings going on. Now, the reason for this is that I had become aware of two writers. One was John Keel. I think many of y'all are aware of him. And the other was Michael Persinger. And these two guys both made the association between weird energies, weird light forms, and mystery hominids occurring in the same areas. What intrigued me about that, and especially with my finding myself back in the venue, so to speak, was that not only had there been a history of wild man sightings in the Big Thicket, there was also a history of unusual light form sightings. I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself here, but we're going to get into that. Both of these gentlemen recognized that association. Mr. Keel wrote about what he called window areas. And window areas are where a range of paranormal phenomena occur. He thinks it's all, or he thought it was all a function of fluctuations of energies, transmogrifications of energies. He had some interesting ideas relative to the nature of consciousness from that. And Dr. Persinger, he wrote a book called Space-Time Transients and Unusual Events, which is a classic. And he also made that association, and he was one of the first people that I had read who actually talked about what he called the standing ghost light phenomenon. And these are places where there's a long history of people seeing these unusual light forms in the same location over long periods of time. And what I realized, and none of them knew about the Big Thicket, but what I realized is that the range of phenomena that both of these men wrote about all occurred there in the Big Thicket. We had the weird lights. We even called them ghost lights. I had no idea that there were any other places where that phenomenon occurred until I read these guys. We had the ape-like creatures. We had the large, unknown black felines, as Persinger called them. Black panthers, they call them in the East Texas. So it was all starting to come together for me. So I thought it would be interesting if I would solicit from my readership information and to see if anybody had any sightings. So I wrote a little article in the paper, and I said, if you've had any kind of unusual wildlife sighting, let me know. I'd like to hear about it. I immediately got two calls from two people in coots, unknown to one another. One of them was a couple, and they had gone to Bragg Road, which we're going to talk about, where the ghost light is known to appear. And people there had developed a tradition of people going there to look for the ghost light. So they'd gone to go to the ghost road, sitting in their pickup, waiting for the light to show up, when, as she said, some kind of ape-looking critter jumped on the hood of our pickup and got and glazed at them menacingly through the windshield, howling. And she said her boyfriend happened to have his deer rifle with him. He takes it down off the gun rack and unloads at the creature. And she said he shot that thing, and there's no way he could have missed. And he said it just got down and ran off into the woods howling. So that, I thought that was an interesting story. The other story was from another lady in Coontz, and she said that when she was in high school, she was part of a group that they called the Rat Finks. This was in the 60s. And they used to have an initiation where they'd, you know, try to scare kids, and they'd take them out to this cemetery. And there was a monument there, a statue of an angel pointing up to the sky. And they'd take him there and say, and, you know, they made it very arcane and say, we'll go out and if we talk to the angel, and if the angel talks back, we'll initiate you into our group. So she said they went out there and they were going through all their little ceremony, and they heard a ruckus over in the maintenance shed of the cemetery. So they went to investigate, and to their total astonishment, she said an ape came out of that shed. And it was on all fours. And, of course, when they saw what was there, they got scared, all ran and jumped in their car. The thing came after them and said it kept up with them for half a mile as they were making their retreat. They all got a real good look at it. They said it looked kind of like a gorilla, and it was basically a quadruped. Now, after hearing all these stories, you may wonder what convinced me that there was reality to these things, because this is still all subject to, though it's subjective. People, they could have seen bears, whatever. What convinced me was in 1988, I went down there, and I'd always told myself, having grown up there, that I could never consider myself a man until I slept alone in the big thicket by myself. So I did. I went out, and what happened? I had fielded a number of these wild man sightings, and I got the feeling that they were using the bayou as a way of getting through the woods, and there was a pipeline right away that paralleled that bayou for miles. And so I just kind of deduced, you know, these things could be using those pipeline right-of-ways. They could go all the way from Louisiana to some way up in Texas just like that, because it's clear. And the pipeline right-of-ways are generally about 75 feet wide, and it's cleared. All the trees and brush are removed. So I found a place on the bayou where one of these pipeline right-of-ways was close by, and it was in the big thicket preserve. And I went out and pitched a tent. And I thought, well, I'm just going to sit here and see what happens. Well, later that night, I decided to move up into a deer, bore somebody's deer blind, because it was pretty nasty on the ground. And so I set up in the deer blind, and about 6 o'clock in the morning, right about an hour before sunup, I heard the most ungodly howling sound that you can imagine. It was so it was so loud as to be indescribable. I said that the closest I could describe it would be like it was a combination of an African lion and a freight train whistle. It was unbelievably loud. It was so loud it made my chest cavity vibrate, and it made the air vibrate. And the undulations and the duration of the howl were also hard to believe. So I got it that I had communicated. And frankly, for a while there, I didn't know what it was going to do. I knew that it knew I was there. But I was defenseless. I knew there was nothing I could do to stop it if it wanted to take me out. So I just sat there. And it went on. It left. I couldn't tell why it had acknowledged me, so to speak, except that it felt like some kind of communication. Now, in the years since then, I've had a number of people corroborate that experience. A couple of them were actually employees of the National Park Service, and reported to their superiors was that they heard a howling sound in the woods that could not possibly be made by any animal known to exist in North America. And these are trained bark rangers that I talked to. Of course, I can't give you their names because they can't be on the record with this. Since then, after my first book came out, I was approached by a lady that I had known all my life. Her son and I graduated from high school together, and then, like in a little town like Sour Lake, we actually were in school all the way from first grade through high school. And she knew me very well, and she came up to me after my first book was published, and she said, "I'm going to tell you a story, and you're the first person outside of our family to ever hear this story. But this happened to my father, and he wouldn't talk about this to anyone because he was sure they wouldn't believe it. This happened about 100 years ago. It was when the oil companies first built the pipelines in that part of Texas. And he was hired, his name was Mr. Petrie, he was hired to ride horseback along the pipelines and to check them for leaks. You know, they do that now with airplanes, of course. But back in those days, did it on horseback. He was between Sour Lake and Coontz, off to the west of the highway between Sour Lake and Coontz, which would put him right in that big Lance Roser unit. And his horse started getting fidgety and bucking a little bit and wild-eyed. So he got down, he tried to calm the horse, and the horse bolted and got away from him. And he said it hadn't gone more than 20, 30 yards from him when an ape ran out of the woods, tackled that horse, and broke its neck and hauled it off into the woods. Yeah. That's pretty tangible. that's pretty material. So that was a very compelling and interesting story. Not going to let me go back. There it is. This is a little pine island bayou, and this runs through the Lance Roser unit kind of follows the drainage of this bayou. This actual spot right here has been the site of a number of wild man Bigfoot encounters that have been reported to me. You can see what kind of country they like. Okay, this is Bragg Road, where the ghost lights and the wild man have been seen for decades. Bragg Road was originally the right-of-way for a railroad that serviced the lumber company. Sawmill. Notice how straight it is. Notice the tunnel effect in the distance. The road is almost 8 miles long and is virtually uninhabited the full length. Some of the woods have been cut along it, but that Hardin County designated it a county park several years ago, the full length of it, so it would always be intact. People have been seeing these weird lights on Bragg Road for many years. Having read Persinger and Keel, and having collected the stories that I had by that time, I was beginning to realize that the Bragg Road was very significant in that there was a high incidence of both weird lights and hairy wild man sightings in this same location. Since the story of the thing jumping on the pickup, I've had two other stories reported to me of similar incidences on the same road. So it would have to have been just a few miles of each other. One of them, a couple was coming back from Houston on the way to Beaumont after attending a church function, and they just decided on the spur of the moment to go out on Bragg Road and just see if they could see the ghost light. She said they weren't there for long when the rear end of their car started bouncing up and down. They looked back, and there was this huge, hairy, ape-looking thing that was literally picking up their car and just banging it up and down. You can imagine how that would affect you. The other incident was reported to me just a few weeks ago by a young man from my hometown there in Sour Lake. He had gone out there with a group of his buddies, and you know, a lot of people go out there and they're totally skeptical of all this, the lights and everything, or they don't know much about it. So they were out there and hadn't been there long, and they heard something approaching them that it sounded like heavy footsteps. And the closer it got, the louder and the footsteps were, and it seemed like they were dealing with some kind of large animal. So they decided to leave. Then the thing started running after them. The kid I talked to was in the back seat. Excuse me, he was in the bed of the pickup. And he said he heard this thing go, and he kept telling the guy, faster, faster, man, this thing is dangerous. So it kept speeding up. He said that he heard this thing just coming right after him. And he said he couldn't quite make out what it was because it was dark, and all he could see was the outline of it reflecting the taillights. The taillights showed the outline of some kind of black mass, so to speak. And he says they kept speeding up, and the thing jumped, grabbed the tailgate, and couldn't quite hold on. They finally got away from it. But he said it literally was trying to pull its way into the bed of the pickup. And he said that whatever it was, it actually left dents in the tailgate from that. Now, these are interesting in a special way. They indicate an aggressive Bigfoot. They indicate that they can actually be hostile. And I my theory is that there could just be some old alpha male, and that's his territory. And if anybody shows up there at the wrong time when he happens to be around, it's typical of Bigfoot encounters that a lot of times they're trying to get people to leave wherever it is that they encountered. So that's the Bragg Road.
Quick question.
Yes, sir.
Obviously, they could be not only aggressive, but violent.
Right.
Has anybody, any human been hurt by any of these things?
Well, you know, that's an open question. Pilates, the guy that wrote the books about the missing people, he's pretty much convinced that some of the disappearing cases of the disappeared people and areas in the national parks and national forests where there are Bigfoot present, he's very suspicious of them. And, you know, despite what the people in the Northwest want to think that Bigfoot's, you know, this lovable little fuzzy little creature, my research and Tom's is that the ones down here we think could be potentially dangerous. John Keel used to write, he called them big hairy monsters, BHMs. He used to say that we may only be talking to the people who got away in terms of having seeing a Bigfoot and being able to report it. So I guarantee you, when I go out in the woods, I'm very respectful of what I think they're capable of doing. And we'll get into that a little bit if we have time. But how important I think one's intention and attitude is if you go into an area looking for a Bigfoot. Now, the mystery lights, the ghost lights, and other mystery light forms that occur on Bragg Road are not limited to Bragg Road in the Big Thicket. And we think that one reason they're so frequently seen on Bragg Road is that it's such a long viewpoint that you have. You're looking at 8 miles with an open view. Now, of course, down there in the woods, you don't have any. If you don't have a road or something, you're hemmed in by the woods pretty much. But I wanted to show you all this. This is a picture of something that I got on film, and this is actually on 35 millimeter film. This is an old this is an abandoned bridge that's now in the Big Thicket Preserve. I went to take a picture of it as a potential illustration for an article about the kids I was telling you about with the cemetery, because I had heard that there had been some Bigfoot sightings at this bridge. And you can see from the top photo that it was starting to get dark when I took the picture. And this thing showed up in the film, the white thing on up on the left. And I didn't see it at the time I took the photograph. But I, and then look down at the bottom picture, see down at the bottom lower left, what happened after I took this frame. The next frame, I crossed that bridge and shot back from the other side of the bayou in the opposite direction, and it showed up again in the next frame. I took this to a photography lab in Beaumont and said, what is this? And they had no explanation for it. And I said, well, just... could it be something on the lens? Could it be some kind of light source there? And the people I had look at it did not think that was likely. They said, well, whatever it is, you got a picture of it twice. Now, as we know, film and cameras can sometimes pick up energy that's not in the visible light spectrum of human beings. Can be real close. And for that reason, you know, that's one of the explanations for orbs and so on. This could be what the old timers in the Big Thicket referred to as a haint, or that's what they called a spirit, a haint. I have never seen this before or since, but you notice it has kind of a three-dimensional, it has some depth to it. It's almost fish-shaped. Well, that's another example of the kind of lights that are seen on Bragg Road. Curiously, some of the other locations where ghost lights have been documented are like in Arkansas, and I've talked to people up there in Arkansas in the area called the Gurdon Lights, and had a gentleman send me a very detailed Bigfoot sighting that he had within just a few miles of where the Gurdon Lights appear in big and up there in Missouri. You've heard of the Joplin Lights. Well, that's right up there, and right where the what do they call the Missouri Monster, huh? Lights. Yeah, I know that, but they have a name for the Missouri Bigfoot.
Momo.
Okay, that's right where that occurs. So again, you have the association, and then in Louisiana, of course, there's weird stuff all over Louisiana. But near Gonzales, Louisiana, they have a ghost light that occurs there regularly, and there is a lot of Bigfoot sightings in that area. California, same thing. In Washington, in the Yakima Indian Reservation, and North Carolina, in the Brown Mountain Lights. In all of these locations, strange electromagnetic anomalies happen weird lights happen and Bigfoot show up. So I think there's a good, all of these make a good case for some kind of a association, causal association. This is another photograph that was taken by me and a friend of mine in 1996, right off of Bragg Road, and we also with 35 millimeter camera. And what we did is we drove to about midway on the road, and we decided we were going to keep an all night vigil there. And what we did is we got a camera, and every hour we would take a picture in each of the cardinal directions, north, south, east, west. And this one, we were facing east, okay? Out of all the photographs that we took over the period of almost an entire night, this came out. Again, I took it to a photographic lab. I said, what is this? We didn't use a flash for these. This was apparently what I had had people describe to me in talking to witnesses about the ghost lights. This is what they call a luminous fog bank or mist or a cloud of mist.
So it was dark.
It was dark. This thing is apparently self-luminous. And this is what the technician was telling me. He said, if there had been a cloud bank there and you had taken a picture with the flash, it would have whited out the frame. And he also pointed out to me, and unfortunately I couldn't get the entire picture to fit on here, but you can see the ground, and it's obvious that the ground is not illuminated by a flash. It's illuminated by this thing.
Now, what's that vertical stripe?
That's a tree.
That's a tree?
Mm-hmm. And if you notice at the top how it's brighter up there, it's more... I actually had a kid report this to me. And I believed him because I had taken this photograph. He said he actually saw this when it was in the visible, apparently in the visible light range. And that, you know, that was one of Keel's pet theories, is that these energies go up and down the visible light spectrum, in and out. This kid actually saw this thing, and he saw the bright white part as the center of it. And he said he saw this bank of mist collapse into the center and form a sphere. And then he said, Mister, I know you're not going to believe this. A Bigfoot stepped out of that light. So what do we got? You know, what sense can we make of that? You've seen the Bermuda Triangle material. Remember the pilot who wrote about I think he called it the electronic fog. He actually flew into what he said was an electromagnetic fog. I think this may be a similar phenomenon. And we hadn't got to that point yet, but one of the possibilities is what's happening with these Bigfoot and why they apparently can appear and disappear is they may have access to some form of interdimensional portals. And when you see these lights, that may actually be what they are, temporary electromagnetic portals between parallel worlds. I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself here, but that's just to show you the kind of weird stuff that goes on.
Big, would you say, that fog bank is?
I would say is about 30 feet across. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember what time it was when you took...
No, I don't. I'm not that scientific.
It was pure dark.
Yes, sir. It was dark. None of that was visible, and my buddy and I were both astonished that we got a photograph like that. Now, so what happened from my first book? I actually wrote my first book not so much as a Bigfoot book or a mystery primate book, as I wanted to present the evidence to corroborate Mr. Keel and Dr. Persinger, and I gave them a lot of credit, and I cited a lot from their material and said, hey, this stuff is real. There are these locations where this range of phenomena occurs, and all seems to be related. It's not, they're not isolated events. But that's basically was my take. Then about, yes, sir.
Good question. Do you have documented what kind of film that you used? You said it was 35mm.
35 millimeter, and it was, I forget the...
ASA 400 or...
I think it was 100.
Whatever.
Yeah.
That's That's good. It's a good.
It was sensitive film. Yeah, I got the highest that I could that would work on my camera.
So it was sensitive to non-visible light as well as visible light.
Yes, sir. Apparently.
So this you couldn't actually see this fog bay. But you were able to photograph.
And I understand from a number of paranormal investigators that that's not uncommon for stuff to show up on photographs that was not visible, and it's happened to me twice out there. So you know, it kind of makes you wonder what's really going on right around you. You know, so I had basically established that, and at that time, I actually thought that Bigfoot was basically a paranormal phenomenon. I agreed pretty much with John Keel that Bigfoot was somehow a manifestation of this light, and that maybe we were only seeing it as Bigfoot because of our contents of our, you know, the reflection theory, that we were seeing what we believed. And, you know, I kind of bought into all that. Then I met the guys at the BFRO, and I went out on a couple of expeditions with them. Then I met Chester Moore from Orange, Texas, and I realized, and I met, what's the dude's name from Louisiana? North Louisiana, you remember him? No, not, he's from Arkansas. But anyhow, I got to know these guys, and I went to a couple of conferences and talked to a couple more witnesses, and I thought, this isn't that easy to dismiss. That there was too much stories. Of course, it was all anecdotal, but there was too much stories and too much evidence that suggested the normal day-to-day survival activities of just a regular animal. So I began to think, you know, this flesh and blood versus paranormal schism is pretty interesting. So I did a little bit more research. I couldn't interest anybody in a follow-up on my first book. And then I met Tom Burnett. My sister moved to North Carolina several years ago, about 5 years ago. And she had been involved in my research and quite involved. And when she got up there, she was at a gift shop in Black Mountain, North Carolina. And she came across this little book called Nature's Secret Agents. And it had a picture, face of a Bigfoot on it. And so she bought it and read it, and she called me up. She says, "Rob, you got to read this book." She said, "This guy has made the same association you have with the ghost lights and Bigfoot, and he has photographs of lights too, that he's been trying to get a picture of Bigfoot. He has photographs of the lights as well." So I read the book. It was horribly written. It was very poor grammar, very poor spelling. It was written like you write an email without spell check. But it had some really intriguing information in it. So I contacted the author, Tom Burnett. And the first time I talked to him, I was shocked because he has one of the last he's probably one of the last surviving people who speak the old Smoky Mountain Appalachian dialect. He sounds like Snuffy Smith, I kid you not. And it's not because he's uneducated. He actually has a college degree, but he lives so far back in the mountains, back in the hills, that that's where he grew up. And so his family, he grew up speaking that beautiful accent. So anyhow, I got to know this guy, and we did more and more research on the association with the lights and so on. And of course, the Brown Mountain Lights, which is one of the most famous ghost light locations in the country, was only one valley over from where Tom was having his experiences, his sightings of Bigfoot. These are some photographs that Tom took. These were made with a game trail camera. He later showed me where he had this set up. It's basically just about 3 foot off the ground pointing into the woods. And he had these light forms show up. And now to picture where he lives on the edge of the Pisgah National Forest, and his house is the last habitation at the end of the road, of an old lumber road, and there's nothing past him but 500,000 acres of woods. This was pointed in that direction. and this stuff shows up. And he says, you know, I have no idea where those, what those lights are, where they come from, what their source is. But what he was trying to do there is Tom was, at this point, he was trying to habituate the Bigfoot into coming into his property. He, what happened is that he was exploring a place to build a house on property that his family had been in his family for 100 years. And he was up reestablishing the property line. And he said one of these things, he was making a lot of racket, and he said this thing come up right behind him and just stopped and looked at him like, what are you doing here? And he said, you know, the way he put it is that the thing was like, that's why he called his book Nature's Secret Agents. He said that thing was on you like that, just like a what do they call those guys? Yeah, like they're trained to, you know, stealth, like they could be on you just like that, especially in the woods. So he had some really harrowing encounters with the thing. One of the things it was doing, it was killing and eating his dogs, just all kinds of bizarre stuff that was going on. And he finally decided, said, well, I'm not going to leave my land, so I'm going to have to coexist with these creatures. If they're going to come on my land, I'm going to make friends with them. So he started leaving out food, and he established an area, a particular place where he would leave food. And he did this for several years. And then he decided to set up a camera. And that's when he started getting these photographs, not of creatures, but of lights. Now, I want to take a brief aside here and talk about the screaming Black Panther. As I was saying, Dr. Perslinger and Keel, one of the phenomena that they mentioned that occurs in their cluster areas, wind areas, is the large black cat. Now, you can go anywhere in the South, and most of the places in Texas, and people are going to say, oh, yeah, we got Black Panthers. And there are not supposed to be any Black Panthers anywhere in North America. But anyhow, Keel and Persinger had both noted not only the appearance of hairy primates, but these big black cats. We came to the conclusion, me and Tom, that probably this was a different animal that knew how to access these power points the same way the Bigfoot does. This track you see here, this photograph was sent to me by a lady who contacted me not long after the publication of my first book, excuse me, my second book. And she was telling me, and she lives in a big thicket, actually, about 50 miles west of where I do. And she said that she had heard a howling sound like I had talked about in the book, that she had seen a lot of lights and UFOs in the sky. And she was wondering whether all this was, you know, part of what I was writing about. And then in a couple months later, she sent me this track. She said, is this a mountain lion or a dog? Well, notice that this track is 5.5 inches wide. Notice that it's wider than it is tall. That's characteristic of felines. A dog track will be taller than it is wide. And a dog track will show claw marks. Notice this shows no claw marks. It's about 5.5 inches wide and about 4.5 inches tall. This is a big cat. Now, whether it was a Black Panther, who knows? But she said she had heard all kinds of weird noises out in the woods. So I think she probably did get one. Although there's a possibility, as weird as this may sound, that this could be a remnant population of the dark phase of a species of jaguar that actually once did inhabit the Big Thicket. It was, the old timers there call it the Mexican lion, because it ranged out of Mexico all the way into Louisiana. It was extirpated 150 years ago, but there is some indication that there could be some pockets where this animal survives. However, I think it's more likely the case because these Black Panther sightings are also associated with magnetic anomalies, blackouts, and such. I think it's more likely the case that this is a part of the Big Thicket's weird menagerie. So why are Bigfoot so difficult to find? Let's address that issue. See this dude here? This is a dude in a ghillie suit. Notice that, you could see how, you could walk right by that. If he had stepped back in the woods of the way, you should never see him, as long as he was standing still. I'm fond of saying that the Bigfoot's, we don't really have to resort to metaphysics to account for the elusivity of the Bigfoot. They're, from all accounts, their coat is virtually like a natural ghillie suit. And you could go, if you go out there in the Big Thicket, the woods are so thick and the sunlight is so dim in the deep, deep woods, one of these things could be 20 feet away from you. If it stood perfectly still in the shade, you'd probably never see it. So it could be that the Bigfoot uses that as part of its camouflaging ability. And that one of the reasons that the Bigfoot are so elusive is that they have that they're experts in camouflage, and as Smiles was saying, I could easily see how they would have plenty of reasons to avoid contact with human beings. If they are as intelligent as we suspect they are, they could be afraid of getting a flu or some kind of infectious disease from us that would wipe them out. Yeah, and or they just may not have any use for the way we live. It's hard as that is to imagine it. So some of the other difficulty in understanding how Bigfoot can be so elusive, I think, comes from the difficulties with some of the commonly employed research strategies that these Bigfoot groups have. They take an attitude of invade and conquer, basically. Most of them are kind of paramilitaristic in their research model. In fact, I actually participated with a group that the leader was a former Navy SEAL. So you can imagine the approach he took to it. But basically, it's like they want to go in, set up, and they basically have a hostile intent. And I think that the Bigfoot would pick that up. Another question that I'd like to pose in terms of this elusivity is, why are experts unable to track down a Bigfoot even with the use of trained hunting dogs? If this is a real animal and it has as much of odor to it as is frequently reported, and it leaves as big a tracks and trail as it's alleged to, it should be real easy to track one down. And yet there are many instances of where there's been a Bigfoot sighting and hunting parties have been established within a matter of just a couple of hours with trained hunting dogs, and they have never been able to track one down. I think a clue into, I think this situation offers a clue and to what part of what might be going on with these Bigfoot. And that is, the dogs are terrified of Bigfoot. I don't know if y'all have read or anything about this. Grover Krantz was the first one to point it out to in my knowledge. But dogs are terrified of, even trained hunting dogs, doesn't matter what species the dog is, doesn't matter how big, what size it is. If they know there's a Bigfoot around, they do not want anything to do with it. So they have an abject fear of Bigfoot. Bigfoot, even though it's, yes, sir.
But you mentioned that. David Politis mentioned that a lot of times when they're looking for those missing people out,
they use dogs.
They use dogs, and a lot of times the dogs can't seem to find the scent, or they just kind of sit down and they don't figure it normal.
Yeah, and he also wrote about how when they did pick up the scent, they wouldn't follow it. It'd freak them out. Yeah, that's commonly reported. Now, what was going on with Tom is that he heard the thing howling out in the woods, And his dogs started disappearing, and he was finding body parts of his dogs that he assumed had been consumed. And he kept a bunch of dogs, and he said any time that there's any indication that these things were around, his dogs would literally crawl under the house or crawl under his bed, and they would inevitably cower. Now, we're talking about big dogs that would go after bears, that'd go after mountain lions. They weren't afraid of those. But there was something going on that they were not experienced with. Yes, sir.
Once he started feeding the Bigfoot in a friendly manner, did they leave his dogs alone?
Yes. That was interesting. And one of the reasons that I wanted to work with Tom is I'm not aware, and I've been doing this for a long time, I'm not aware of anybody who has habituated any kind of a population or number of Bigfoot to his personal property. And it took him years to do it, of leaving out food every couple of days to spend a lot of his own money. And he said, yeah, after a period of time, he said he'd go out to where he left the food. And he said, all right, I'm going to feed y'all now, but I want you to quit eating my dogs. And and that's exactly what happened. And now, interestingly, he said they started leaving him. They started bringing him stuff. Like where he left the food, he would go there and he would find a pile of acorns or a pile of feathers. And I forget one of the ape experts that you were talking about. One of the characteristics of primates is gifting, and primates are the only animals that do that. I thought that was a really interesting observation. That if he's gotten to the point where they quit killing his dogs and they started gifting him, well, we got something to work with. So, have y'all ever heard of the invisible gorilla experiment? Yeah, that was where they had a group of two different groups. I think there were five or six people in each group, and they were bouncing a basketball, and you were told to focus on the ball. And count how many times it went from one player of one color to the other, or whatever, and focus on it. And then during the middle of that, without telling you, they had a guy dressed in a gorilla suit walk right through the players. And so then they would ask people, did you notice anything? And about 50% didn't see a thing. The balance of them saw maybe a blur, but they couldn't figure out what it was. That was me. I saw a blur go through there, but I never saw it. And then the remainder, I think it's about 35 or 40%, said, yeah, somebody walked through in a gorilla suit. But that illustrates what they call inattentional blindness. That if you have your attention focused on something, something could be right in front of your face and you'll never see it. And as hard as that is to believe, these guys have demonstrated this experimentally of at least 50% of people. And I was one of them, I had to admit. So I think, and this is part of what we call the blind spots, psychological blind spots or perceptual blind spots. And I think there's a possibility that Bigfoot is aware of this tendency in perception and can somehow make use of that. There is a tradition that the old Apache scouts, Tom Brown, you ever read any of his books, survival books? Well, the old Apache scouts were trackers, the supreme trackers. And they had the way that you would measure how good a tracker they were is how close they could get to their intended prey before they shot it. And you weren't considered to have reached the highest skill level until you could actually touch it before you shot it. And what they did is they made use of the blind spots of their prey. So they're all animals or creatures have had it, and they would study, like if they were going to kill a deer, they would study that deer and watch its habits, and said its habits would create a perceptual rut, so to speak. You get caught in that rut, you got blinders on. This is what you see. And they would make use of that, and that's how they became such good trackers. So I think the Bigfoot may be employing that. All right, so does that imply that the Bigfoot may have any psychic or paranormal powers? This is all camouflage. It could easily camouflage itself with its ghillie suits. It may understand something about what the Apache scouts understood and employ that. So what evidence do we have that there could be any psychic or paranormal parameter to that? Well, you see this dude here? That's what in Louisiana they call a rougarou. Now, they give it wolf-like characteristics, but you can imagine that if you were in the woods and you saw a Bigfoot, a man-shaped animal covered with hair, that you could imagine it could be a werewolf as well. And in France, they had legends of the loup-garou, which was basically a werewolf. And so the Cajuns brought that tradition over with them to the States. And there are people who think that what the Cajuns think is a loup-garou is actually a Bigfoot. But interestingly, the Cajun fishermen and the people who go way back up in the Tuffalo Basin, they have a superstition, supposedly, that when the rougarou is in the area, things start going haywire and their equipment will quit working for unknown reasons. Their boat motor will cut out. Their, you know, whatever machinery they depend on will start malfunctioning when a rougarou is seen in the area. Well, I knew about that tradition, and I soon found out I was to be tested with that experience. Spiles and I went to join a man that lives right on the Louisiana border, Chester Moore. Chester called me, and he said, Rob, he said, I want you to come down. I've had some sightings reported, and I think you might be interested in investigating them with us. He said that, Chester was an outdoor writer for a couple of newspapers in Southeast Texas, Orange and Port Arthur, and he's very well respected. Outdoor writer and hunting guide. He's a very good guy. Smiles and I both. He's friends of ours. Anyhow, he says, I think you might want to come down and check this out. And I had just met Smiles, and so I invited Smiles to come along on the investigation. Now, it was cold. This was in January, and we had a norther blow in on the way down there, and by the time we got there, it was about 20 degrees. So we really had to be motivated to go out. And what happened, he said, he had somebody contact him and said that they had been out on one of the bayous right off the Sabine River in an area called Blue Elbow Swamp, and that they had seen what they assumed was a wild hog swimming in the water. Said it was a big, black, hairy animal, and they saw it swim across this little channel of the bayou and crawl up the bank. But it said when it got up to crawl up the bank, it reached out with hands. It said it freaked the guy out. He says that wasn't a hog. It actually had arms and hands. So he called Chester. Of course, Chester had a reputation. Chester called me and said, let's go check it out. So within the next, I guess within 2 days of that initial sighting, we were there. We went out. And Chester was an expert in animal tracks. And we went out, I get you remember this, Mark. We went out and immediately found some tracks that were suspicious. And we did castings of them, and they weren't shaped like normal humans. They weren't real big, but they didn't look like normal human prints, and they were barefoot. And who would be barefoot in the swamp in 20-degree weather? But on the way out there, Chester is one of those diehard flesh and blood guys, okay? And I told him right as soon as I met him that I thought there was a paranormal aspect to Bigfoot. He didn't think so, but we got to be friends anyhow, so he invited me to come out. And so as we were going out to where the tracks were, back up a little bit, Smiles and I got on the boat, and he met us in about a 12-foot flat-bottom boat, and we had to go a couple miles up into back into the swamp, and his dad was going to meet us there and set up the camp. So as we're getting on his boat, I looked down, and Chester had the name of his boat was Swamp Devil. I said, Chester, so we got in and we were pulling out. I said, Chester, I said, man, you've been holding out on me. You said, you've been holding out on me. You've been telling me that you were, there's no way this could be anything but flesh and blood. And you're calling your boat the Swamp Devil? I said, what's that about? And so he just kind of smiled. And so we're pulling out and he's revving up his motor. I said, Chester, I said, you know, that's what the Cajuns call the Bigfoot. And he says, what? I said, they call him a Diab, the devil. And he couldn't quite understand what I was saying because his motor was getting louder. So we're revving up. We're going out in the channel. And he says, what? I said, they call him Diab, the devil. And I was practically yelling it out at that time. And his motor cut out, went dead right there. I swear to God. And I looked at Chester. I said, Chester, do you realize what just happened? I said, I mentioned the word devil, and your motor goes out. He says, I can't believe it. He said, I've never had any problem with this motor. He said, I checked it this morning. There's nothing wrong with it. Well, his motor had not only gone out, it had become, it froze. He couldn't account for it. So we had some paddles with us. And since I was an old man, I got to supervise Smiles and Chester to paddle us back to the nearest sandbar where we called his buddy for help. Well, his buddy shows up, and his name was Bubba. And Bubba shows up, and he picks us up. We load all of our gear, and he's getting ready to take us out to the camp. And his motor, he couldn't get his motor to start. It just quit working. And I said, man, I'm sorry about that. I said, let me see what I can do. So I got out of Chester's boat. I went over to Bubba's boat, and I did some little stupid thing. I said, okay, it should work now. He cranked it right up. But that was a bizarre experience because it was too coincidental to be a coincidence, in my opinion.
Do you have anybody there named Brudeau?
Man, we had Chester's dad is a grade A, what they call a grade A coon ass back home. Good people. But I wouldn't let Chester get away with that. I said, Chester, a Rougarou knocked this motor out and you know it. And I said, I don't mind telling you, when that motor went out, I started looking around. And we got out there and that's when we found the tracks. And whoever had been there, remember this, Smiles? Whoever had been there the night before had left suddenly and left all kinds of, there was some camping gear or something that they abandoned. Somebody left in a hurry.
Camping gear, kids' toys, I think, and shotgun shells in every direction.
Yeah. Something showed up and scared these people. They obviously responded with gunfire and they left post haste.
With a emptied, yeah, shotgun shell?
Yes. And that was in an area literally on the Sabine River, right across the river from Louisiana. So that led me to think that there was some substance to the Rougarou legends. Now, one of the difficulties I think that we have, I think that Bigfoot has telepathic ability, and that's one of the ways it can. That it can augment its camouflaging ability. And one of the reasons I think that we have a hard time understanding what telepathy is, let's face it, telepathy is not really very well researched in this country. But if you go to Europe, it's a different situation. How many of y'all are familiar with Dr. Sheldrake's research? Just tremendous material. He speaks of telepathy in a really interesting way. And it's a way that a Choctaw Indian medicine woman, a very similar way as to what she explained it to me. She says, when you think of telepathy, don't think of thoughts. Think of pictures. Think of intentionality. And one of his classic books was Dogs Who Know When Their Masters Are Coming Home. When they did these experiments with dogs that would go sit at the door when they knew their masters were about to come up. And they did all kinds of things, changed the times that they would come, had them come from different places, take different lengths of time to get home to try to throw the dogs off, but it wouldn't throw them off. And so from this and other experiments, Dr. Sheldrake deduced that they were that these animals were using telepathic abilities. And he thinks that this is normal. This is the normal form of communication in the animal world, at least the higher animals. That he calls it mind-to-mind, direct mind-to-mind communication. And it's done more through images than it is through, you know, we think in words, and the Bigfoot may not do that. The Bigfoot may be thinking more in pictures. And that's what I had the Choctaw told me, that the way they communicate is with what she called head speak, with mind pictures. And so the idea, you had a bunch of guys show up at a Bigfoot research site, and there may be Bigfoot there, and they're all talking about all, using all their paramilitary stuff, and their thinking and their intentionality and the images in their mind, a Bigfoot's going to pick that up. And it would be a very simple affair for them then to make themselves scarce to those kind of researchers. Now, our good friend Nick Redfern, mine and Smile's good friend Nick Redfern, he wrote a book in which he reported on Russian and Czech research from Dr. Kaczynski, Dr. Porchnev, and Bykova. And Kaczynski had not only deduced that telepathy was the normal means of communication among animals, but Kaczynski had postulated an energy carrier for it. And he called it bioradiational energy. And that this was the magnetic carrier that the minds of the animals used. And so I thought, you know, I bet you that bioradiational energy is the same energy that produces the ghost lights. I bet you they're talking about the same thing. Now, these energies can reach immense proportions. In the mid-80s, there was a blackout of the entire region of Southeast Texas. The entire utility went dead. They couldn't find an explanation for it. They said that a transformer had gone out near the Arkansas border, and there, you know, it had cascaded and blah 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 blah. Nobody bought it. Nobody bought the theory. I had a reporter from the Beaumont Enterprise come. He came to interview me, but he told me that he happened to be out that night. They ended up calling this the Beaumont blackout. He happened to be out that night. Making a withdrawal from his bank at an ATM, and it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. And he said not only did all the lights go off immediately in the city, but his car lights went off. His car went dead, just boom. And so whatever turned off the electrical utility for the region was also affecting electronic equipment. This happens in micro form on Ghost Road, the same kinds of immense magnetic energy surges. So it can happen on a region-wide level. Now, Porchnev and Bykova actually applied their research directly to Bigfoot. Kaczynski was dealing with animals in general, but Porchnev and Bykova, who were Russians, I think Kaczynski was Czech, they applied their research directly to Bigfoot, and they deduced similar things, that the Bigfoot was capable of camouflaging itself through manipulations of what they call its biofield and so on. So, but there's been some interesting research done in Europe with the connection of energy fields and telepathy and so on to not only Bigfoot research, but research in general. Now, I want to show y'all the picture that Tom made that's on our website. I don't know how clear that is, man. This is a photograph. Now, can you see at the top, can you see what look like eyebrows?
Yeah.
And right below that, you see these two big eye-looking things? Can you see it? Okay. If you'll notice, over here, you can see the faint outline of its front leg, and then its rear sticking out this way. See it? And notice the lines. You have the hip, then you have the break for the shoulder, and then it goes straight to the top of the head. No neck.
Is it standing up or sitting down? I guess.
We think it's sitting down on all fours. We think that this is a full frontal shot of a quadruped primate, and it's leaned over and it's standing on its front feet. Now, some people look at that and say, "Oh, that's just the rear end of a bear." I said, "Well, why is a bear got eyes and eyebrows on its rear end?"
From that tree in the background, were you able to get a possible
size? I'm getting there. Now, if you'll look around, so you can see that the eyebrows. And you see the two eyes and the shoulder come down here. I'm not going to tell you what that is. You can figure that out for yourself. Never mind. All right. Now, Tom made this photograph in 2012 after years of trying to get a picture of this creature. He knew there were creatures on his property because of all the interactions. He had about a half a dozen actual actual sightings. And, of course, he heard howling many times. He had his dogs. He said, and I told Tom, I said, you know, the way those dogs react to this thing, I think is one of the best arguments that Bigfoot is real, because a dog's not going to be hallucinating. We don't even know if dogs are capable of hallucinating or imagining, and they're encountering something that they don't want to deal with. So now I want to show you the comparison of this first let me show you this. Okay, so we think this is an adult male. It was made in 2012. Only a few months after that, Tom got this photograph on the right. Notice the camera that he had is set to be about 3.5 feet off the ground. So he estimates from that this creature in this picture, this is a close-up, and he estimates that this thing was probably 4.5 to 5 feet tall. Notice that it's got a flat face. Notice the nasal bridge. Now, the picture on the left is a baby howler monkey. Notice the nasal bridge. Notice the size of the eyes in proportion to the head. Notice how the eyes are set in a bony eye socket, and they're set in the eye socket. Primates, this is characteristic only of primates. Only primates have eyes recessed into eye sockets with bony eyebrows. That's the only animals that do. You can see here a faint suggestion of its nostrils. See here and here. And in my opinion, you can see the hairline, see it like it on the baby howler monkey, and you can see it over here. It's almost identical. In my opinion, these photographs are very similar animals. Tom thinks that the picture that he got is a juvenile Bigfoot about 4 feet tall. And he says he thinks the only reason he got the picture is that the juveniles are stupid. And they're not as cautious as the adults. And that he just got lucky and got that picture. From everything I can tell looking at that, it looks like the morphology of those two animals are virtually identical. Now, we were talking about Chester Moore. Chester's made many outings. He doesn't do it anymore, but looking for Bigfoot. And he's had several instances where he's heard the things howling in the woods. He got to where he called them howlers. And he told me that he thought that whatever we were dealing with was somehow related to howler monkeys. And at the time, I thought that was crazy. But from Tom's photographs, I think what we might have here, and there's the creature, I think what we might have here is somehow related to howler monkeys because it exhibits a lot of the same characteristics. It howls a lot. Notice how, well, it may be hard to tell on the screen, but the creature on the left, the hair is very long. You notice how manicured it is? There's nothing. And look down here on the bottom right. See that bear? See how tangled up and messed up his fur is? Grooming is characteristic of primates. It's like this thing has been grooming itself or groomed by something else. Now, the picture on the top right and the picture of the we call it the creature, were made by the same camera at the same place. So on the top right, you have a black bear. You notice how different, if this, the creature on the left, if it were a bear, a rear end of a bear on all fours, it would have to have a very extremely weird, screwed up spine. They just don't match. The back of the bear is rounded. This thing comes up to a point. See, they're totally different. Now, the picture on the left and the top right, you can see from the background that they are about pretty close to the same distance away from the camera. Okay? Again, you have the difference in the shape. And in the case of the bear, the average black bear in the Smoky Mountains is about 2.5 feet tall. If it's on all fours, it's about 2.5 feet tall from the ground to its shoulder blades. Okay? It's about 2.5 feet. This thing on the left, if that's an average size bear in the upper right, if that's 2.5 feet tall, look at this thing. It's got to be at least 4 feet tall at the shoulders. If that's one from the back, and that would make it one huge bear. So we know that nothing can be proven by photographs, and we don't expect, you know, anybody to believe any of these stories just on the basis of these photographs, but we think they're highly suggestive. And interestingly, since our book has come out, I have received information from two people. Now, you're talking about Bigfoot showing up in places that you wouldn't expect, like near Austin. I've had two really compelling locations reported to me, one near between Cleveland and Livingston, and one not too far from Giddings, up in what they call the Post Oak Belt. And there's a region up there they call the Yewa Knobs, where the Yewa, there's like several tributaries of this creek system called the Yewa. And this lady claims that she had seen one there. And I actually went to her location and talked to her in some detail. And her reports were very compelling. And she talked about seeing weird lights. She said they actually had weird lights come into their house. She talked about hearing the howling sound, UFOs, the whole sequence. So that was very interesting. And then the other one was down near between near South Houston National Park, between there and the preserve, by a lady, and the same thing. She heard the, how she was the one that had the Black Panther track. So, yeah, I think there's more of these places. I think it's going to come out that there may be more of these places than we think than we would think imaginable, where this kind of thing is happening.
To say in your book, there used to be sightings in the Lake Travis area a long time ago.
Yeah, that was many years ago.
A long time ago, before it was developed out there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, and I tell you where there was too is between Lake Travis and Marble Falls, up in that it's in the Balcones Canyon lands now. There are sightings from that area from many years ago in those canyons off the Colorado River. Well, that's it. Any questions or further comments?
First, thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure. It's hot, but
finally. So the picture on the top right there, there's a date underneath it, but I'm not sure if that applies to the top picture or the bottom picture that says March 2009. But both of those are presumed backsides of bears.
Yeah. And they were actually made with Tom's camera, the same location. See, it's had it set up for years. But you can see the body shape's totally different. And the eyes are compelling. And now, unless Tom is lying, he didn't doctor this photograph. And I don't believe he's lying. I don't think he's smart enough. No, I'm sorry. I don't think he's trained in computers enough to be able to fake that. I know I couldn't. So now it's interesting to me because the reports that I've had from the Big Thicket, this thing was a perfect description because it had typically been reported as being quadruped, having long black hair, and the size and everything would be very consistent. Oh, I know what I was going to tell y'all. We're talking about the possibility of the Bigfoot actually maybe being actually a resident of a parallel reality, okay? That it's not really part of this reality, but that it can access these areas where the ghost lights occur and as portals to this one, can stay here for who knows under what conditions and can get back through there. I had a really interesting conversation with I recently had my 50th class reunion, and I had a classmate of mine, and he knew that I had written the book, but he hadn't read either one of my books. I hadn't talked to him since the day we graduated from high school. But he says, man, he says, I got a story I want to tell you. He says, I don't know if this has anything to do with your book, but he said, when we were kids, I went out hunting, squirrel hunting, just north of Sour Lake, out in the woods. And he said, I came up on this tree, and I heard a lot of activity, and I thought I'd found me a tree with a nest of squirrels. So he says he sneaked up on it, pull up his, you know, rifle, was just fixing to shoot, and then he got a good look at the thing, and he says, it wasn't a squirrel, it was a spider monkey. And he said, not only was it a spider monkey, there were 12 spider monkeys in that tree. I said, spider monkeys? He said, yeah. I said, that's a tropical species. I said, that couldn't even be an escapee. That couldn't even be a case of escapees because they wouldn't survive the winter. Even a mild winter would probably do them in. And he said there were 12 of them. He literally counted. And I said, now, let me tell you something. He says, you hadn't heard this story, but I actually reported this in my first book in the late 60s. Some squirrel hunters in Tyler County, which is the next county over from Hardin County, did the same thing, except they actually shot a spider monkey. They thought it was a squirrel. It hits the ground. They realized it's a spider monkey. They took it into Beaumont to the newspaper, had it photographed, and all signed a sworn affidavit that their story was true, that this hadn't been staged in any way, that it was shot in the woods. I said, there's two instances there of something being there. And, you know, there is a phenomenon they call out-of-place animals. And one explanation for out-of-place animals is that they could accidentally access wormholes that connect one place in this reality to another. Like there could be some kind of little wormhole thing going on between Southeast Texas and South America. How do you account for that? So that's just another example of the weird little anomalies that occur down there, yes, sir.
You alluded to in your conversation there about a smell.
Yes.
Okay. Is the lights and a possible identification or maybe possible identification of a Sasquatch and the smell all the same time?
I don't know. You know, Keel thought that the smell that people hear smell from Bigfoot was just the typical, you know, hell is supposed to smell like sulfur. And Keel thought that something of the involved with the process of the, what he called the transmogrification of the energy from one form to another, produced a byproduct of hydrogen sulfide gas. And so it could be connected that way, and it could just be smelly animals. And well, now, there are apes. My understanding is that there are some of the great apes can also project a bad odor. Like they have glands in their body that kind of like skunks do. Yeah.
About October of last year, there was about 15 to 16 of us did a CD5 in Wimberleaf. And that's a Stephen Greer, Dr. Greer's, you know, Skywatch.
Mm-hmm. Looking for UFOs. And we confirmed that we thought that there was a portal because we seen a light flash. And one of the ladies that I was with, named Liz, said that she saw a Sasquatch and she saw it on the back of the circle. And it's dark, but she could see that the silhouette of it. And I heard the walking. And we were sitting pretty close together in things. So, and we seen that and heard that about three times that night. We had, the first thing we did, we had this distinct picture of a light, like a door opening, mm-hmm. you know, and then somebody walking in and closing it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a close description of. I've actually had people. I've talked to a couple of witnesses who said they saw something like that. They said it was like the Bigfoot was stepping out of the light. Right. Yeah, they didn't think of it in terms of an opening, but obviously could have been an opening.
Sure. So anyway, that was that's a wondering.
Well, you know, it's interesting, but the guys Kelleher, the guys that did the research at Skinwalker Ranch. You know, they recorded basically the same series of phenomena that go on at the Bigfoot locations, and I'm convinced that they were onto the same phenomenon that we're dealing with here. But what was interesting, after all their years of research, he said that they didn't gather a single shred of what they would call hard evidence for the existence of any of the stuff that was reputed to go on there, except that there were cases where they would have three or more of their scientists, researchers, witness the same thing at the same time and all describe it in exactly the same way. But they would have cameras going, whatever, nothing ever recorded. So my question is, what do you accept as evidence? I would accept multiple witnesses. I would accept that as evidence. Yes. Whether or not you could come up with a single shred of physical evidence to support it, I would accept that as evidence. Yes, sir.
So, what you're describing is accurate. And we've got two things going here. We've got phenomena that are showing themselves, or lights. They're becoming visible to normal eyesight. And in other situations, you've got lights that are showing up on film.
Right.
They're not being able to see it with your eyes. The ones where you're seeing it with your eyes, they're not necessarily showing up on film.
Right.
If that's correct.
Yeah, that's the case.
That is really bizarre.
It is. And, you know, Keel talked about it. He says that he thinks these games kind of go up and down the visible light spectrum, in and out of it.
So it's a matter of timing as to whether you can see them,
right,
or capture them on film.
Right.
In your book, you talk about this, I guess, this duality between these two different kinds of manifestations, these two different types of encounters, the ones that seem more along the lines of what Vora Coleman and others describe as apes, North American apes.
Right, and I firmly believe that that's what Bigfoot is.
And then this other type of encounter that definitely seems to go more into the paranormal. Mm-hmm. Something you didn't touch on tonight, but that you touched on in both of your books, is a completely different kind of interpretation, the possibility that this is
remnant population of some kind of previously indigenous.
Native. That would get into what I call a shamanic connection. And there, you know, I think there's four or five different possible model explanations for what's going on here. I'm not sure we'll ever know which, if any, of these models actually fit, or may there may be more one model that more than one model fits it all at the same time. But yeah, that has to do with the you know, many of the Native American tribes, they were aware of these Bigfoot. They were aware of the weird energy. I had a Choctaw from Mississippi email me right after my first book and says, "I'm glad to see there's some white men that are finally starting to understand a little bit about this." He said, "We've known about this stuff for 1,000 years." I said, "I got it." But yes, sir.
Well, when you were in your Bigfoot research, did you come across the lady where he just asked the ancient ones?
Yes. Well, you know, the a lot of the Native Americans think that the Bigfoot are actually an ancient form of Indian.
You're the ones with the long white hair instead of the long crown hair.
Yeah, well, the ones with the long white hair just may be old ones. You know, they may be like us. They may just go white when they get old. I know I shaved my beard because I didn't want to have a white beard. And, yeah, the place where the Bigfoot occur in Big Thicket, as I mentioned to you, that Indians avoided it, but I think it's because they knew there was weird stuff going on there, that they really knew that there was weird stuff going on there. But there were, the one place where they would go was in the springs that Sour Lake was named after, and they considered it to be a healing place. And warring tribes from the coast all the way up in East Texas would meet there, and they would declare that this is a holy place. We don't mess with this. But the Native Americans and other ancient cultures came to recognize where energy spots occurred, and they considered them to be power spots. If you've ever read any Paul Devereaux, he writes a lot about the relationship between these the energies in these places with consciousness. And the idea is that the power spots were places where that there was energies that facilitated going from the human world to the spirit world. And they said that the Bigfoot or the ancient ones could walk in both worlds. They could go from one world to the other. And that was why they were sacred to the Indians.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you again for all coming out, and we'll be seeing you soon, hopefully.
Yeah, thanks for putting this together.